Oxfam and a network of about 80 aid agencies issued a report yesterday warning of a serious humanitarian crisis unfolding in Iraq. The crisis puts almost 8 million Iraqis at risk, which is a quarter of the population. Meanwhile, between 10 and 50 Iraqis are being killed daily across the country. Today, we take a look at a new documentary created by a one-time war supporter turned war critic. Charles Ferguson's No End in Sight examines major policy blunders in the U.S. occupation of Iraq that have directly led to the current chaos plaguing the country. These include the use of insufficient troops, which led to the looting of Baghdad, the de-Ba'athification or the purging of professionals from the Iraqi government, and the disbanding of the Iraqi military. Charles Ferguson is no anti-war activist. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former CEO of a technology firm. He has taught political science at MIT and journalism at UC Berkeley. No End in Sight is his first documentary. It won the Documentary Special Jury Prize at the 2007 Sundance Film Festival. The film was executive produced by Alex Gibney, director of the Academy Award-nominated Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. I spoke last week with Charles Ferguson. Where I'd like to start is the major themes in your film, which are the major, as you see it, policy blunders of the occupation. The first one being simply doing this entire U.S. invasion of Iraq with really far fewer troops than really was needed. Where did that decision come from, and how did you unravel who made decisions about troop levels, and what were those consequences?
That decision, the troop level decision, came from Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz, both of whom believed, for reasons best known to them, I have to say, that it would be possible to conduct the invasion and occupation of Iraq with as few as 50,000 troops. Paul Wolfowitz told an acquaintance of mine that less than 50,000 troops would be required. He said that well before the war, of course. The military strongly disagreed, and people in the government with military experience strongly disagreed. For example, Secretary of State Colin Powell, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and Colin Powell's Chief of Staff Larry Wilkerson, ironically, all three of them in the State Department, all three of them former career Army officers. Career military officers, Armitage was in the Navy, and they and the professional military objected strongly, and in the end there was a compromise, and the force level chosen was 160,000 troops, still inadequate, but much higher than Rumsfeld initially wanted.
What were the consequences of just having too few troops, from your assessment of talking to all of these officials?
Well, first of all, it made it extremely difficult to control looting and impose law and order. And secondly, it also made it effectively impossible to guard everything that needed to be guarded, which first of all permitted a lot of looting, and secondly meant that there were enormous weapons caches throughout Iraq, which went unguarded for weeks or even months, and after the insurgency began, were looted by insurgents and also, by the way, massively by criminal gangs.
On the issue of looting, many of our listeners remember that the only, and you point this out in your film, that the only place that was guarded after the invasion was the Ministry of Oil. However, there were definitely many instances of troops just standing by and watching and actually not doing anything to prevent looting, even if they would have been able to.
Yes, that's correct. And
was that a specific policy decision?
Yes, that there were explicit orders from the Pentagon, from Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and his office, to the military, not to interfere with the looting and not to declare martial law.
I'm speaking with Charles Ferguson. He is the director and producer of the new documentary, No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq. It's his first film. Now, Charles, would you say that you feel that the invasion was done with relatively good intentions, but that it was simply the occupation that was just horribly mismanaged?
Well, in some sense, perhaps, it was done with good intentions, but part of having good intentions is being careful and not being arrogant and not being careless. and everything about this war, including the initial invasion, was done with remarkable carelessness and arrogance on the part of the administration, I mean to say. I'm not speaking now of the professional military. The professional military actually conducted itself very well during the war, and in many cases even during the occupation, although it certainly made some mistakes during the occupation. But the civilian leadership, the senior administration officials who controlled American policy, were disastrously wrongheaded from the very first.
What was the thinking behind the purging of professionals from the Iraqi government and also then the entire disbanding of the Iraqi military, which your film makes a great case that, that really those decisions laid the groundwork for what we're seeing today, the violence and chaos we're seeing today? What was the thinking on the part of members of the Bush administration to make those policy decisions?
Well, first of all, both of those decisions were made in an appalling vacuum of information. The people who made those decisions, a small group of men who had never been to Iraq, Paul Bremer was on his ninth day of work in the Pentagon when he made those decisions. The people who made those decisions did not consult with anybody on the ground in Iraq, either the first civilian occupation authority there, run by General Garner, or the American military commanders on the ground. And in fact, everybody opposed those decisions when they were made. So first of all, they simply didn't know what they were doing. To the extent that they had a particular view about what they were doing, it seems to have been that, now we own the place, we can do anything we want, and we simply want to get rid of everybody and everything that had anything to do with the prior government, which was a vastly mistaken view, because there were many people, both in the government and in the Iraqi military, who hated Saddam and who had continued in their jobs only because they, first of all, needed to earn a living, and secondly, they didn't want to get shot.
You interviewed a couple of folks, you interviewed a lot of people, officials who had served various roles in the occupation, including Walter Slocum, a senior advisor for the National Security and Defense of the Coalition Provisional Authority. What role did he play in this decision to disband the Iraqi military, and how was his, how did he sort of justify it?
He played a very important role in it. That decision to disband the Iraqi military and secret police and intelligence services also, by the way, seems to have been made principally by Slocum and Bremer on May 9th, the day before Bremer left for Iraq. Slocum's own role was astonishing. He had been previously in telephone communication with Colonel Paul Hughes, who was in Baghdad in charge of recalling the Iraqi army and putting it to use to stabilize the country and begin reconstruction. And Slocum reversed that policy and that decision, once again in an extraordinary vacuum of information without having consulted anybody about the decision. And when he made the decision, when he and Bremer made the decision on May 9, neither of them had ever been to Iraq, which is kind of surprising.
Did you believe him when he tried to assert in your interview that he did, inform the right people about his decision to disband the military?
I was skeptical, and then I checked, and he didn't. He lied.
Let's talk about Jay Garner, Paul Bremer's predecessor. He attempted to play a role in post-invasion Iraq that in a way he wasn't allowed to complete. What was his feeling about the way in which the management of the occupation then played out, particularly under Bremer?
He's terribly sad and very distraught at what happened. And in fact, after he left Iraq in the first week of June, came back to the United States. When he came back to the United States, one of the first things he did is he went to see Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. And he told Rumsfeld personally in his office that he thought that Bremer's initial decisions were disastrously wrong. And Rumsfeld replied to him, "Well, we are where we are, and that's that." And that's all he said.
Did what was his position, particularly on some of the issues of the purges of Iraqi professionals from the government and the disbanding of the Iraqi military? Was he pretty clear that those were things he would not have approved?
Yes, in fact, he protested both of them to Bremer. As was typical throughout this period, Bremer didn't consult him and didn't tell him in advance of these decisions, so he learned about them only very late. General Garner learned of the debathification decision, the decision to purge the government of members of the Ba'ath Party, by accident when he was walking down a corridor, and he ran into one of the ambassadors who was working for the occupation staff and who showed him this debathification order that Bremer had just written. And General Garner took this ambassador, Robin Rafel, and the head of the CIA station in Baghdad. The three of them went to see Bremer, and they tried to persuade him not to do this. But Bremer said, "I have my orders, and I'm going to execute them."
I'm speaking with Charles Ferguson, the director and producer of the new documentary, No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq. It is going to be opening in theaters on August 3rd, and we'll give listeners that information near the end of the interview. Now, Charles, you interviewed a number of people. You interviewed dozens of people for this documentary. How did you decide who to interview and who not to interview? And were you turned down for interviews?
Well, many people, of course, refused to speak, particularly senior administration officials. And,
such as?
Oh, I asked them all, from President Bush on down. Secretary Rumsfeld refused to be interviewed. Condoleezza Rice refused to be interviewed. L. Paul Bremer initially said yes and then backed out.
Did they know where you might have been coming from?
I think that was probably part of it. I think part of it was also that they knew that I had a substantial background in policy analysis and that I knew what I was talking about. And I think that they were just as afraid of that, actually, as of what my political views might have been. I actually had been sympathetic to the idea of using military force to remove Saddam Hussein before the war. I thought he was a genocidal dictator. I thought that he was a danger to regional stability, and I thought that if it could be done in a way that wouldn't destabilize the region, that it would be a good thing for the region and for the Iraqi people. However, that's not to say that I was in favor of what the administration actually chose to do. So it wasn't, you know, I don't think that they turned me down primarily because I ideologically disagreed with them, although I certainly don't see the world the same way as they do. I think that they simply were not interested in being exposed to very difficult, very tough questions.
It seems as though the people who did agree to speak to you are people who no longer have as big a stake in the occupation, people who are no longer part of the administration of the occupation, like Barbara Bodine and others. Is that about accurate?
That's largely accurate. People are, of course, much freer to speak when they're no longer in the government. Some of these people, though, began speaking out relatively early, and in some cases when they were still in the government. And there's one person who's quite prominent in the film, a Marine lieutenant when I interviewed him, now captain, who is still in the active duty military, and in fact right now he is in Iraq.
And then you also talked to a few Iraqis, and there's a lot of footage from on the ground. How was that aspect of the film conducted? Who were, did you yourself travel to Iraq, and were you involved in the filming process, or did you have correspondents?
Yes, I went to Iraq. I spent about a month in Iraq in March and April of 2006. I took with me two experienced journalists, one of whom was also a former intelligence agent who served as a personal bodyguard as well as a journalist. And the three of us took a lot of footage. I took some of it myself. A lot of it was taken by the other two because they could go places that I couldn't. They spoke Arabic. They could pass for Iraqis. And one of them, Nir Rosen, for example, took the footage that we have in the film of Muqtada al-Sadr's sermon, which we filmed in 2006.
Charles, why did you make this film? What was your main goal in putting this together? I mean, there have been a number of documentaries on Iraq. This is definitely a different one.
Well, I felt that it was important for there to be a film that could be widely seen, that covered in a very general, broad, comprehensive way how we got into this and why Iraq is in the horrific condition that it's now in. There have been other good films about Iraq, but they've been very specific, very personal, and have covered very limited subjects. I don't mean to denigrate them. Some of them have been very good. I thought The War Tapes was a very good portrayal of what life is like on the ground for American GIs. But I felt that it was important to make accessible to a very wide audience a general picture of how all this happened.
Do you think your perspective is fairly reflective of the American mainstream, which is now largely against this war, that perhaps had it been conducted in a better manner, had the occupation been conducted in a better manner, that the invasion and occupation of Iraq would have been or could have been a good thing?
I'm honestly not sure if that's the mainstream view in the United States. I guess it probably is. It certainly is the view of the majority of the experts with whom I've spoken. Most people with whom I've spoken think that if this had been done competently, it could have turned out much, much differently.
Well, given the history of the United States in other conflicts, and even in Iraq itself in 1991, and as you point out in your film, the fact that George Bush Sr., you know, encouraged Iraqis to rise up and then did nothing to support them. Do you feel that believing in the noble intentions of the Bush administration was really wise in retrospect?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. We should probably all have been more skeptical than we were about the administration's intentions. But beyond the administration's intentions, I have to say, I was utterly stunned at how rigid and blind and incompetent they were, whatever their intentions were. Whatever the administration's intentions, I don't think that they wanted Iraq to look like it does now. But they didn't listen. Many people tried to warn them. Many people tried to inform them, but they did not listen, and they went out of their way, in fact, to suppress dissent and discussion.
And do you feel that the reason why that they were so supremely arrogant and incompetent was because many of them, I think you point this out in your film, many of the decision makers just simply never served in the military or really didn't have as much, I mean, they were familiar with Iraq, but they didn't, hadn't really served personally in the military?
I think that's definitely a factor. I think lack of direct personal experience contributed to their arrogance and their sense that they didn't have to pay attention to others. And I think if they'd have had direct experience with the military, with post-war reconstruction, with the Mideast, that they would have been somewhat more humble, and they would have realized that the obstacles before them were larger than they realized, and that they had to pay attention to expert opinion.
Finally, Charles, what do you think needs to happen now, in particularly in Iraq, from your study of the situation? Can the clock be turned back? Can the chaos that has been unleashed be undone in any way, despite the fact that hundreds of thousands have died?
Unfortunately, I don't think that the clock can be turned back. I think that now Iraq is such a chaotic, violent, disorganized place that it's going to be a very long time, 10, 20, maybe 30 years before Iraq can become a stable, normal, peaceful society again. And I think that the best that the United States and the international community can hope for now is to control the violence and keep it from spiraling out of control and becoming truly horrific and genocidal, which is a very real possibility.
And what should the United States do, given, as you've made the case in your film, the invasion, the occupation rather, was managed so horribly? Can the U.S. be trusted to continue to manage the occupation?
Unfortunately, I don't have much hope for this administration. I strongly suspect that a productive change in American policy towards Iraq is going to have to wait until a new president takes office.
And what do you think such a new president ought to do? Withdraw troops? Keep them in? Have a United Nations oversight?
Most of the people I've spoken to think that it would be catastrophic if the United States were to withdraw all of its troops, because the presence of the American military, for better or worse, is the only thing that is preventing truly horrific bloodbath in the first place, and also a wider regional war between Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria. So some level of American military presence is going to be required probably for a very long time. But yes, the level of that presence can be and should be, needs to be reduced. I think that greater international and United Nations involvement would be helpful. Negotiations with the other countries in the region, including, unfortunately, Iran, which is not a nice country, but is nonetheless important to stabilizing the region. All of those things are important.
I've been speaking with Charles Ferguson, one-time war supporter turned war critic and member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the writer and director and producer of a new documentary called No End in Sight, which opens this Friday at the Lumley One Colorado Theater in Pasadena, at the Sunset Five in West Hollywood, at the West Park Eight in Irvine, the Landmark Theater in Los Angeles, and the Edwards University Town Center Six in Irvine. For more information, you can visit noendinsightmovie.com. That's noendinsightmovie.com.